Welcome to the Tailwind Coaching Podcast, hosted on the Daily Grind Cycling Journal. Visit us on the web at tailwind-coaching.com or like us on Facebook at Tailwind Coaching. And now, your host, Coach Rob.
All right, everybody. Welcome back to another edition of the Tailwind Coaching Podcast. Welcome to all of my weekend warriors, my club riders, my racers, all of you who are listening out there in podcast land. Today, we're going to tackle something that a lot of you have been asking me about in the past few weeks. In fact, we're going to tackle something that's such a broad topic, it needs more than one podcast to even cover. All right, that podcast is going to be, well, this podcast anyway, the topic is going to be climbing. And this is going to be the first of at least two podcasts on the topic of climbing and how to be a better climber. Most people have a certain thing that they despise in terms of cycling. Some people hate flat roads. Some people hate headwinds. A lot of people hate hills. In fact, more people than anything else seem to hate the hills, and people even avoid hills wherever possible. So let's try and figure out how to make you, my listener and my subscriber, a better climber. All right, first, a couple of very quick housekeeping announcements. One, I have one, that is one remaining spot for coaching this fall. For those of you who are looking at a boost in your fall season goals, whether they are centuries, whether they are finishing up your criterium season, or whether they are one of my favorite things on the in the racing world, that of cyclocross, you cowbell-waving psychopaths, as you might be. I love each and every one of you, and I love to race cross. If cross is one of your big goals, I still have one spot available if you're looking to boost your fitness for cross. following my own plans, over the past season, I've seen a gain of almost 35% in functional threshold power. Other people who are following my similar plans have seen gains of anywhere between 20 and 30% as well. So, if you're looking for a little bit of help in your cross season, your late season goals, go ahead and drop me an email at coachrobdc@gmail.com or contact me on Facebook at the Tailwind Coaching Facebook page. For those of you listening to this podcast on iTunes, if you like what you hear, please rate it. Please rate it favorably. The more ratings I get, the more visible this podcast is, the more people it reaches, and the more motivation I have to continue giving you all of this great information. Remember, I don't get paid for any of this podcasting stuff. I do this because I like getting the feedback that people are getting better and that people are actually enjoying what they hear. All right. So if you do like what you're hearing, go ahead and leave me a positive review on iTunes. If you're listening on Stitcher, Blueberry, Podbean, on the website, etc., etc., if you have a few minutes, head on over to iTunes and go ahead and leave me that positive feedback if you are so kind as to do so. All right, training plans, downloadable training plans. I'm going to have a coupon coming up here in probably the next week or so to kick off the end of the season, the end of the road season, and the beginning of cyclocross season. And I will probably be in the next month or so releasing a cyclocross specific module to go along with the rest of my modular training plans. It will probably be a four-week module, much like the climbing module is, and with any luck, that'll be about a month out from here. So keep that in mind, keep an eye out, and there'll likely be a blog post out there about that. So that all being said and done, let's get into the meat of today's podcast, the meat of today's show, part one of the climbing podcast. And part one of the climbing podcast is going to be essentially what makes a climber, your power to weight ratio, et cetera, different positions and different skills that climbers can use. We'll be getting into that right after this. All right, so you're one of those people that absolutely hates going uphill. So much so to the point where you'll actually look for a workaround on your route so that you don't have to climb. Every time you come to a climb, you look up the road and you just drop your head and go, ugh, another one. Why? Let me tell you something. I used to be the exact same way. I used to look up the road and see the road go up, and I used to think exactly the same thing. Ugh, another climb. But you know what? That was years ago, and now, what is my strongest point of my cycling and my strongest cycling ability? Probably my climbing. And I didn't get there because I just went out and rode hills. I know a lot of you out there believe the idea of getting up hills better is to climb more hills. Well, yes and no. That works just fine for the beginner cyclists. Those of you who've been riding for less than 3 years, go ahead, go out there and just kick every hill you can in the ass, and you will get faster. You will become a little bit better of a climber just by going up hills more often. I know a lot of you do hill repeats in order to work on your climbing ability and your climbing prowess. Let me tell you something. It isn't going to help you that much, okay? If you've been riding for 5, 6, 10, 20 years, and you're still not a great climber, but you haven't changed your training, the way you train or the training that you're doing, then you're doing yourself a disservice, all right? Sure, there are some people out there who will never be great climbers. There are those of you out there who have so much fast twitch muscle and you're so beefy and burly because you've got so much muscle on your frame, you'll never be a great climber that competes with the featherweights, you know, the 120-pound guys who are standing at 5'10". You're never going to compete with them. However, you can be a better climber than what you are now, all right? The first way to figure out how to be a better climber is we need to define what makes somebody a good climber, okay? And there are a couple of things that really do that, all right? One of those things that makes a good climber is their power-to-weight ratio. Now, this is the toughest part because a lot of this is genetically driven. Okay, some of you who are big, again, big, burly, beefy guys who are sprinters, think of the Andre Greipel kind of body morphology. You're not going to change that. You have a lot of mass on your frame. You have a lot of muscle on your frame. However, you also produce a lot of power. The problem is you don't produce a lot of power per kilogram of body weight or per pound of body weight. All right, that's the key to being a great climber. If you look at the Tour de France and you look at some of the guys who are in the top 10, setting aside the fact that most of them are, shall we say, artificially enhanced, setting aside that fact, a lot of these guys are putting out huge watt per kilogram numbers, and that is a lot of power with a little bit of weight. All right, climbing is mostly, not all, but mostly, about the fight against gravity, okay? As the road pitches up, you fight against gravity more than anything else to propel yourself forward and up that climb, all right? The more power that you produce, along with the less weight that you have to drag uphill, the faster you can and will travel uphill, the faster you'll climb. So it makes sense that you have two options in terms of increasing your power to weight ratio. That is to produce more power. Not a problem for some of you bigger guys. Some of us little guys, however, have a hard time putting out more and more and more power. And the other option is to reduce weight. Really a good idea for those of you who are carrying around a little extra something, okay? That summer beer spare tire of yours is certainly not doing you any favors when the road pitches upward. And I don't think that's any secret to anybody who's listening, all right? Now, of course, the perfect alternative is to do a little bit of both, all right, is to lose some body fat, lose some body mass, and increase your power, your functional threshold power, your VO2 max power, et cetera, et cetera. That will all help you be a stronger, faster climber, all right? However, there are other things that go along with climbing, all right? For those of you who are good climbers, you'll know this. Those of you who are struggling a little bit may not. A good climber will have the ability to switch on and off, or switch from one energy production system to another. Now, let me explain that. It's not even so much energy production systems. It's not even so much anaerobic versus aerobic. However, that does enter into the picture at some point. However, they're able to switch between their muscular endurance system, the system where you put a lot of tension into the pedals at a lower cadence, and their very aerobic, spinning, high cadence system. Okay? Now, I use aerobic and muscular endurance. Aerobic would be your system where if you're climbing a hill, you're out of breath. Okay? That means you've overrun your aerobic system. Your body cannot get enough oxygen in to produce the power you need. All right? Similarly, your muscular endurance system, when you're pushing a hard gear at a very low cadence and you can't turn the pedals over anymore, that's essentially the point at which you've exhausted your muscular endurance system. All right? Great climbers will be able to switch between those two systems and give that one system that they're taxing at the moment a break. Even if you can give that muscular endurance system a break of 20 seconds, that's enough time for your body to sort of re-energize a little bit. All right. So by taking the stress off one system and putting it upon another, you suddenly find yourself a stronger climber, a faster climber, and fresher at the top of that climb, no matter how long the climb is. All right. Again, this is one of those things that makes a great climber. All right. And the last thing, obviously, the intangible that makes a great climber is the ability and love of suffering. All right. Nobody ever said climbing was easy. Even climbers say that climbing is not easy. However, they have this stupid little thing in their head that says that I'm going to go up this hill as fast as I can and I'm going to hurt. I'm going to make everybody else with me hurt. And I'm going to try and make people throw up. I'm going to try and make people vomit off the side of their bike. All right. That's what makes mentally a strong and powerful climber, is the ability to not only suffer yourself like a dog, you know, when your legs are burning and your lungs are burning and you're thinking, your brain's telling you, I need to stop. That little tiny part of your brain that's deep in there that you can't even imagine where it is, you can't even think about it, just pops up and goes, oh, baby, it hurts so good. And then you look over and you see the guy next to you with his tongue hanging out and the sweat pouring off of his face and he's got that vacant stare in his eyes. You know that black kind of tunnel is closing in on him. You look over and you see that and suddenly, I got to turn the screws a little more. I got to kick it again. I got to hit it a little harder. And when you see them just throw their head down and shake their head and just give up, suddenly that is the greatest feeling and that spurs you on even further. That kind of sick, it's almost a mental sickness. That kind of sickness, that kind of mental capacity and that mental toughness is really the intangible that makes a really awesome, great, powerful climber. Okay? So, with those three things in mind, all right, power to weight ratio and ability to switch your energy systems and give one system a rest, and the ability to suffer, all right, with those three systems, with those three things in mind, how do we build on each one of those? How do we make each one of those a little bit more useful to us? All right, well, to make yourself a stronger climber from the power to weight ratio, you can work on your skills, your power production. All right. If you are, you've got your skills down, you're looking at ways to switch energy production, switch your energy systems, give one a rest, we can look at saddle positioning and positioning on the bike. Okay. And in terms of ability to suffer, we can look at a few other things in terms of mental toughness training and things like that. All right. We'll go over some of that as soon as I get myself a little drink of water, and I'll be right back after that. All right, so you're interested in building your fitness in order to climb better. Well, there's a certain number of, let's call them physiological skills, which makes the act of climbing a much easier endeavor. All right, the number one skill that one has to possess in order to be a good climber is a solid foundation of muscular endurance. All right, the ability to put a lot of force and a lot of tension into your pedals for an extended period of time without breaking down, without having your body fail. Okay, so many times you have So many times I get questions from people. Geez, I'm having trouble climbing. I hit hills, and suddenly, you know, once I hit the hills, I'm doing great. I'm doing great, and then suddenly I lose my breath. I'm out of breath, and I have to stop. Well, part of the problem in that case is generally someone who has excellent aerobic endurance, but very poor muscular endurance. They're afraid to shift into those harder gears. They're afraid to use those harder gears for fear of tiring their legs out. So they rely on their aerobic energy production systems, and subsequently, once those are taxed and tapped out, they're done. Their climbing is finished. All right, until they recover. You see, people have to pull over and take a breather a little bit. All right. Building muscular endurance is the key to being a strong climber because it provides the foundation for every other activity and every other skill that you use while climbing. You follow me here? All right. Muscular endurance intervals are usually anywhere between 15 minutes and 60 minutes of continuous high tension, low cadence work. All right, and the reason for that is because sometimes we do experience climbs that are anywhere between 15 minutes and 60 minutes, especially if you live in Colorado or California or the European countries where you have the Alps, the Dolomites, things like that. All right, muscular endurance is the key, and the ability to have enough muscular endurance to not break down over the course of an entire ride, not just one climb, but an entire ride, is of paramount importance. It's great if you have enough muscular endurance to hit a 15-minute climb. But if you burn it all out, and you have nothing beyond that 15-minute climb, you're screwed for the rest of the day, man. You're done. So you need to have a reserve of muscular endurance that will enable you to continue throughout your ride and attack every single climb that you see. All right. And again, those kind of intervals are those regular high tension, low cadence intervals that I have every single person do who's following any of my training plans. Every single person will be doing those, and probably a good 30 to 50% of some plans is muscular endurance work of one sort or another. All right, so that's the first thing that's of value to a climber. The second skill that's exceptionally valuable to a climber is the ability to produce high force on the pedals. Okay, and this is something that actually leads into the next skill, if you will, a little bit. The ability to put high force into the pedals for not even a sustained period of time, but a short period of time. High force would be determined as beyond that muscular endurance tension. Think of grinding out a hill at 60 RPM and barely being able to turn over the pedals, having constant, continuous, brutal tension on those pedals. Now you're talking force-type work, okay? And that force-type work is absolutely necessary, all right? Because as you need to rest your aerobic system, you may need to drop your cadence down to that 60 RPM, and you may need to be able to produce that much force on those pedals, all right? And that kind of force production is also an essential component of the ability to stand out of the saddle on the pedals and produce power. So the ability to produce high amounts of force while putting high amounts of tension into the pedals and produce high amounts of force is an absolute necessity for a good climber. Now, I'm not talking about just any climber. I'm talking about the good climber who can really kick ass on most climbs. All right. Following with the force skill and the muscular endurance skills, putting those together are the standing skills, the ability to jump out of the saddle or get out of the saddle and change position on the bike. Now, this will get down to into the positions on the bike which change your energy production systems. All right, so we'll get there in just a minute. But standing, the ability to stand not for two or three pedal strokes and put down high force, but the ability to stand for 15 seconds, 30 seconds, a minute, 2 minutes. The ability to stand and attack a climb by putting forth an additional amount of force, an additional amount of power into the pedals. All right, that's a very essential skill. I have a in my climbing modules, I do standing drills with you. All right, specific drills which will teach you to teach you and train your body to stay out of the saddle for a certain period of time, a certain length of time, and the physiological adaptations necessary to make that happen. All right. That is an essential skill for someone who's going to be a good climber, because you can't just sit in the saddle continually and grind away. I mean, you look at guys like Fabian Cancellara, very much a seated type of climber, compared to someone like an Alberto Contador, who's a very frequently out of the saddle climber. All right. And standing is also an important thing to note. The lighter weight you are, the lighter weight your upper body is, the more you will be able to stand to climb. So those of you who have a larger upper body, big, muscular, or even maybe a little spare tire going on, you're going to have a harder time standing. Therefore, that standing skill is something that you need to work on even more so. All right. Following up, the standing, the muscular endurance, the force production skills are kind of the ability to speed up, hit a hill, hit a climb, add power, add speed on that climb, and then recover. My favorite workouts for these are my Zone 5 repeats, which I talked about in my Zone 5, my VO2 Max podcast. The Zone 5 repeat is one of my absolute favorite workouts, and it applies to climbers in the following way. How many times have you watched on a professional race or watched in a race, a domestic race, or even on TV, or even on a group ride? You're hitting a climb, you're managing to hang on with a group, suddenly somebody ratchets up the pace, okay, whether they stand and jump out of the saddle and make an actual attack, or they simply ratchet up the pace, and you fall off the back, or you watch somebody fall off the back, all right? What happens in that case? Well, in that case, there's two things that are happening. One, either that particular rider is significantly stronger than everybody else, or two, they're simply moving from a zone 4 or threshold level effort into a zone 5 level effort for a few moments, a few seconds, maybe half a minute, and they're suddenly dropping back, trying to maintain that gap by staying at a threshold level effort. Okay? Zone 5 repeats are designed to do exactly that, and I've discussed them in my previous podcast. I'm not going to go through them here, but essentially the physiological challenge in that case is to train your body to go above its threshold and come back and recover at its threshold. All right, those intervals are absolutely essential to someone who's looking to make gaps on climbs, push the pace on climbs, attack, or even cover attacks from others or cover accelerations from others. All right, you need the ability to ramp up to that zone 5, that VO2 max level effort, and then drop back to that threshold level effort. Okay, and finally, the last physiological skill, obviously, that's of great benefit to a climber is simply a high functional threshold power number or value. All right, the higher your functional threshold, actually the faster you'll be able to climb, the less work you'll have to be doing, the less you'll have to be into that zone 5, and essentially the fresher you'll be at a faster pace. All right, and there are thousands and thousands and thousands of ways to really do zone 5 or threshold, functional threshold, I should say. There's like thousands of ways to do threshold work. I do several different ones with my athletes. Every coach has their own particular way of doing functional threshold raising work. And pick your poison and pick which one works for you. All right. But those are essentially the big five physiological skills that climbers need or somebody needs to develop in order to be a strong climber. Now, here's something to take note of. Muscular endurance and high functional threshold are not just climbing skills, obviously. Those are very, very handy skills to have, very handy physiological conditions to have in order to be a fast rider in general. high force production works very nicely for people who are looking to be more powerful sprinters, or in fact, even more powerful time trialists. those Zone 5 or VO2 max repeats are a wonderful, wonderful thing for people who want to stay with group rides. About the only skill in those five that really is 100% dedicated to climbing are standing skills. All right. So if you're thinking to yourself, wow, these sound like what I'm doing a lot of right now, you're exactly right. You're exactly right. Everybody's going to be doing a fair amount of the skills they need to be a climber. All right. A big part of becoming a good climber, even though you may be working on these skills already, is the mental aspect of working on these skills and applying them to climbing situations. All right, so that gets into the mental toughness aspect, which we'll talk about in a little bit. However, going back to the standing physiology, the physiology of standing, that opens a can of worms such as let's put it this way. It really leads us right into the ability to switch energy production or energy systems. Give your aerobic system a break, put some tension onto your muscular endurance system. All right. And most of the time, we do that by changing the position that we're on in the bike. And we'll go over those positions and we'll talk about that in just a second. All right. Swapping and giving breaks to your different energy producing systems and saddle or out of the saddle positions. Interestingly enough, that's essentially how we're going to change our energy production systems. All right. A lot of the energy production system change comes not only with body position, but with pedal speed. All right. Higher cadence tends to be more of an aerobic capacity issue. Lower cadence stuff tends to be more of a muscular endurance issue. However, the ability to change position in the saddle is also a key to being a great climber. Actually, even being a decent climber. Various muscle groups tend to work together to provide propulsion while we're on a bike. And if you can give one of those muscle groups a rest while putting the impetus on the other groups around it, you can stay fresher longer and essentially overall ride faster. All right, so let's examine some of these saddle positions that you will probably be using as you climb hills. All right, first of all, we're going to talk about positions in the saddle. So if your butt is planted on the seat, there is the back of the saddle position, which many riders tend to prefer on longer climbs. And the reason why it's such a great position and is so efficient is the back of the saddle position actually extends the distance between the hip and the pedal contact position on the bike. All right, it allows a much more full extension of the leg. Typically, when you're fit to your bike, you are fit to approximately 30 degrees or so of extension. I'm sorry, about 30 degrees of flexion, 30 degrees from full extension of the knee. You never want to have your knee locked while you're pedaling. You never want to have to really toe down the ankle significantly while you're pedaling. But sliding to the back of the saddle actually increases that extension to less than 30 degrees of flexion, typically. It actually increases ankle dorsiflexion or toeing down. And that combination, that toe down of the ankle, that contraction of the quadricep and the hamstring, the contraction of the gluteus muscles, the muscles in your that make up your butt, that extension of the hip, the extension of the knee, and the plantar flexion of the foot, that combination is the absolute strongest, most powerful combination of muscle contractions in the body. Period. End of story. All right? That's why you see guys that are able to squat hundreds of pounds, while you don't have too many people who are able to curl hundreds of pounds. Okay? It's that extension of the lower body and glute is one of the most powerful forces you can produce through the body. So why not take advantage of it? All right, sliding to the back of the saddle brings those powerful glute, those huge, huge, by size and volume, very large muscles, which are full of slow twitch fibers, aerobic fibers that are designed for long-term work. All right. It brings those glutes into the equation. All right. And bringing those glutes to the party and adding them to that powerful extension stroke gives you a lot of force and a lot of power and a lot of very slowly fatiguing power in your pedal stroke. Okay. So back of the saddle is a great place to start from. All right. But what happens when you get tired on the back of the saddle? You slide forward, right? You just slide forward. Slide forward to the tip of the saddle, on the rivet, as they used to say, because old-time saddles actually had a rivet on the nose of the saddle. And when guys would cover up that rivet, they're putting out a lot of force, a lot of power. They're really trying to move it. They were deemed to be on the rivet. You've probably heard Liggett and Sherwin or Sean Kelly or any of those talking about being on the rivet. That's exactly what that means. Why would you want to do that on a climb? Well, by sliding forward and sliding closer over the bottom bracket, number one, not only do you change your center of gravity, especially as the hill steepens, as the road steepens, you're able to keep that front wheel planted more, and you're able to keep your weight distributed more evenly on the bike, but you're also more quad and hip flexor dominant. You can bring that big psoas muscle into play more easily. You can bring those quads into play more easily. All right, and it is often necessary on steeper pitches to add that extra power to get over those steep pitches. It also allows for more aero position, but that applies much more so on flat terrain than it does climbing. The effect of drafting and aerodynamics tends to go out the window at less than 12, 13 miles an hour. Most amateurs that I know, most of the guys that I coach are not climbing 16, 17 miles an hour unless it's a very shallow grade climb. All right. The problem with sliding forward in the saddle is simply that the quadricep is not designed as a postural muscle. The psoas is not necessarily designed much as a postural muscle. It tires much more easily. So sliding to the front of the saddle very typically is only done for seconds to a few minutes at most in order to give that extensor muscle group a little bit of a break. Let it recharge its battery, so to speak, so that you can get back to those really powerful muscles in the back, the glutes, the hamstrings, the gastroc, and even the back and core muscles. All right. So back of the saddle, front of the saddle, alternating those two while seated is an incredible way to swap those muscle groups around and sort of change where your power is coming from. All right, and is often very necessary depending on the steepness or the pitch of the climb. And now let's get into standing. When you hop out of the saddle, most of you probably watched the tour, or a lot of you have watched the tour. A lot of you watched those guys, quote, dancing on the pedals as they climbed some of the harder climbs in the tour, Aix-les-Trois-Domans or Mont Ventoux or any of the other ones, the Semnoz or any of the tough climbs. All right. What is standing? Why is it so good for a climber? Why is it so necessary for a climber to be able to use that kind of technique? Well, first of all, let's talk about the problem. The problem with standing is that there's a significant increase in the pressure on your legs, and that's due to your upper body weight now being supported by your legs. When you're sitting, when you're in the saddle, when your ass is planted right on that piece of carbon, whether it's hard, soft, or whatever the case is, your body weight is being taken up by the bike itself. Your legs are free to move from the hip and do nothing but power the pedals. Okay? When you stand up, now your legs have to support your upper body as well as turn the pedals. All right? So if your upper body is, say, 60% of your overall body weight, which in some people it certainly is, if your upper body is 60% of your body weight and you weigh 200 pounds, you're suddenly taking your legs from supporting just themselves, all right, about 80 pounds, to supporting an extra 120 pounds of weight. Now, obviously, it's not going to be 120 pounds because your upper body is, you're still holding onto the handlebars, let's put it that way. And some of that weight's taken up by your hands. But, by and large, your legs take up a lot more pressure. They have to support that extra body weight. That's why when you stand, A, you put out a lot more power. B, your heart rate goes up more significantly because you are using more muscles. You're using muscles to support your body weight as well as push the pedals. Okay? That being said, even though that is a problem, Why is standing such a necessary thing for us to learn how to do? Well, as you stand, that extra body weight that you have the ability to throw that into the pedal stroke, okay? You have the ability to use your body weight to simply push the pedal down. And this is really a great technique to understand and to be able to realize. And I work on this in some of my standing drills with some of my athletes. It's a great way to sort of take some pressure off your muscular system by simply using your body weight to push down the pedals. All right. I can remember very distinctly the very first time I raced Baton Kill, cramping horribly by mile 40. The only way I managed to survive to the end of that race was simply to throw my body weight into the pedals every time the road pitched up. If I tried to even contract muscles to bring that pedal around over the top, I would cramp. So I had to use my body weight almost alone, almost in solitude, my body weight to push those pedals. And let me tell you what, it actually worked for 24 miles, okay? All right, so the ability to throw your body weight in the pedals not only gives your body, your muscles a chance to rest, but it does give you the ability to put extra power into the pedals. All right, and that's why it's necessary to train that small ability. All right. And like I said, increase in power production. You can produce significantly more power standing than you can sitting, sometimes to the order of nearly double what you can produce sitting. It just depends on the capacity of the particular rider, all right? Another one of the benefits, all right, to standing is the ability to have multiple hand positions, which will change your body mechanics, body language, how much force you can put into the bike, et cetera, all right? If you're on the hoods, if you watch someone like Alberto Contador, who when he stands, he climbs on the hoods very often, on the top of the shifters. Your chest is nice and open. You can take in big breaths. You can take in a lot of oxygen, all right? Your upper body is a little bit more quiet. It doesn't use a lot of extra energy when you're on the hoods, all right? So the only problem with that is you're standing tall. As you stand tall, any kind of wind resistance becomes a factor. A headwind becomes a significant factor if you're standing up nice and tall on the hoods, all right? Look at guys like Marco Pantani. The late pirate who just recently obviously was busted for using EPO in the 1998 tour, but nonetheless was still a a fantastic, amazing climber. He favored climbing in the drops. Climbing in the drops, obviously much more aero position with your back flatter to the top tube. Actually much more forward position for very steep gradients. Sometimes you'll see even people who are not really good climbers, even on very steep stuff, you'll sometimes see them climbing in the drops, only because it moves their center of gravity significantly forward towards and even forward of the bottom bracket, and also keeps their center of gravity nice and low to keep that front wheel on the ground. You can also contribute a lot of upper back and body English, and a lot of upper back and body and core power and force while you're in those drops. You're able to pull against those bars much more efficiently in the drops than you are in the hoods. All right. Now, the downside of standing, again, even though it produces a lot of power, it has a high energy cost. We can combat that a little bit by training in standing positions. And again, this is the reason that standing is one of the physiological the important physiological markers of a good climber is the ability to stand efficiently, okay, and very smoothly. Many, many people, when they stand up out of the saddle, become what I like to say, herky-jerky. All right, they look ugly on the bike. Their pedal stroke falls apart, and their ability to be efficient goes right out the window, right down the toilet, whatever you want to call it. So training that inefficiency, getting rid of that inefficiency and training that ability to stand becomes a very, very important thing. Again, a very important physiological skill. Okay, so backing up to our hand positions here, I'm realizing that hand positions also are not just an out-of-the-saddle thing. Okay, hand positions are a very in-the-saddle thing to look at as well. Okay, and before I forget, something that I probably should mention. I don't like it, but I will mention it. When standing out of the saddle, there's also the mountain bike grip hand placement. I don't like it because it's not a very stable hand position. And if something should happen, you should need to get brakes or grab a gear or something like that. You simply can't do it. The mountain bike hand position is, of course, hands on the top of the bars, the flat part of the bars on either side of the stem. It's a very narrow grip. You have very little control, and it's a very awkward grip. I only mention it for completeness sake. I've only seen a very few people use it, and let me tell you something. They were not really great climbers, okay? Out of the saddle, they were just not in good shape, okay? But in any case, in just a moment here, I'm going to grab a little glass of water, a little bit of a drink here, calm my voice a bit, and I'll be back. We'll talk about hand positions, and we'll talk about the ability to suffer on climbs. All right, hand positions. Now that we've gone over standing hand positions, it seems it's appropriate to go over hand positions for the seated climbing that we're going to do. In fact, it's worth noting that most of our climbing here is going to be seated. It's a much more efficient way to climb. We can still moderate our energy production. We can moderate different muscle groups by sliding forward and backward on the saddle. We can moderate our energy production by changing our cadence, a fast cadence being more aerobic, a slower cadence being more muscular endurance-based. Okay, that being said, what do you do with your hands, the rest of your body, the part that isn't doing much of anything? If you watch any racing, professional, continental, you know, even local racing, plenty of guys have plenty of different odd hand positions. And that's the beauty of a drop bar bicycle is the ability to put your hands in an almost infinite number of different places. All right, but the most common ones are very simple. In fact, the most common one for a long climb is probably the hands resting on the tops of the bars. Okay. And again, just like the mountain bike standing grip, the mountain bike grip you use when standing, or hopefully don't use when standing, we're talking about the flat part of the bars on either side of the stem. And when we're talking about gripping that flat part of the bars, we're not talking as much about really grabbing with a death grip, okay? If you're white-knuckling your climbs, you're wasting a lot of energy through your upper body and through your hands and through your arms and forearms, all right? You only really need to rest your hands on those bars, lightly wrap your fingers around to maintain control, okay? Oftentimes, you see guys who are, quote, settling in to a climb. They found their rhythm. They found a nice pace for a long climb. That's where you're going to find them most of the time, all right? It's a very versatile position. You can slide forward on the saddle in order to rest your glutes, hamstrings, etc., and really engage the quads and hip flexors. You can slide backwards on the saddle and still not have a lot of arm extension. You can use those powerful glutes and hamstrings, etc., etc. And the nice thing about being on the drops is your position is more upright. So while that may be an issue with aerodynamics, if you have a headwind, it does open your chest up significantly. It allows you to take those really deep belly breathing types of breath, and it really allows you to get a lot of oxygen in. Okay. Next position that you're going to see people in, and probably the one you see them in the next most or the next most often, is in the actual hoods. All right. The hoods obviously are a regular riding position. For descending, a lot of people seem to call that the uncomfortable handshake or the awkward handshake. But for climbing, it's not really much of an issue. Again, you don't want to be white knuckling anything while you're climbing. Otherwise, you're, again, going to be wasting a whole lot of energy that you could otherwise be putting into the pedals. All right. The hoods allow you to either slide forward on the saddle or slide further back. However, sliding further back onto the saddle while in the hoods will tend to increase your torso angle compared to the top tube, close off your diaphragm a little bit, close off your chest, and may contribute to difficulty or harder breathing than you would be having otherwise by closing off your airway. The upside of the hoods position is that there are probably a million hand positions you can put your hand or rest your hand in on those brake hoods. It's a very quick transition from seated to standing climbing, especially if somebody should make an attack or the pace should ratchet up suddenly and you don't have any more cadence to ratchet it up with. Okay. It's also extremely easy to shift and to brake, shifting being the most important, obviously, on a climb if you need a lower or higher gear as the terrain itself changes. All right. The final position, again, just like standing up out of the saddle, hands in the drops. The biggest problem with the hands in the drops, even though it's an aerodynamic position, is it does close down your chest significantly more than the top of the bars or the hoods, and it's typically very generally a tip of the saddle position. All right, I've found that with myself and most of the athletes that I coach, being in the drops and trying to slide to the back of the saddle just gets extremely awkward. It puts a lot of tension on hamstring flexibility and back flexibility. Also puts a lot of tension on cervical or neck flexibility. And it in general is somewhat of an awkward position to slide to the back of the saddle on the drops. Again, it's a great position to stand from, to switch from seated to standing. It's a fantastic position to accelerate from. If you're going to make an attack on a climb and you're comfortable, drops are a great place to do it. It minimizes the amount of draft you'll be giving your opponents or your victims, I should say. And it really does allow you to put a lot of power into the pedals by using your upper body and back as contributing muscles, and putting a lot of torque into that pedal stroke. All right. Now, we've gone through a whole lot of information there. We've gone through a lot of the physiological skills for climbers. We've gone through some of the ability to switch your energy production systems, give muscle groups a rest, give your anaerobic system a rest in favor of aerobic system, and et cetera, et cetera. What gets down to the last thing? We're going to get down to the last thing that makes a climber, and that really is their ability to suffer. And a lot of that is a mental aspect, the ability to really enjoy the pain that you're causing others and causing yourself. But there are ways that you can train for such eventualities. Probably the best way to train for hill climb suffering is the good old-fashioned hill repeat. And I'm not talking about from a physiological standpoint. I'm talking more from a mental standpoint. Okay, going out and hitting hills over and over and over and over and over again, and coming to terms with what it's like to have to put out that kind of power and have that kind of pain, searing through your legs and your lungs and every other part of you, and how to recover after those. That's the mental aspect of doing hill repeats, hill repeat work. All right, you have to toughen yourself towards the pain and the difficulty that you're going to feel on a climb. All right, even the best climbers in the world will tell you that climbing is not easy. All right, but enjoying it becomes much more simple if you're familiar with the pain you're going to deal with. I worked out, I rode an event up in the Finger Lakes called the Highlander. And that event has a climb on it by the name of Bopple Hill. And Bopple Hill was a very, very steep climb, approximately 3/4 of a mile or so in length. I believe the average grade is about 13.5%. And it's followed by a longer climb of about 2 miles with an average grade of about 10% by the name of Gannett Hill. I'm trying to remember those numbers. If they're incorrect, I apologize. I believe they were somewhere in that neighborhood. However, I went out reconning parts of the Highlander before I had ridden it, and I sort of thought that the reports of how bad Bopple Hill was had been exaggerated. Unfortunately, Climbing it the very first time, I realized that it was really no joke. It was an extremely, extremely tough climb. And I sort of was able to mentally prepare myself for that climb when we did it during the actual Highlander itself. The climb up Gannett Hill, however, I had never never reconned and very rarely rode anything of that length and gradient in any kind of training. And that kind of climb was, that climb was actually sort of my undoing at that point. And mentally, I was just unable to cope with the physiological and physical stress that I was under for that climb. And to be perfectly frank, it cracked me. All right. So the mental aspect of climbing is almost as important as the physiological aspect. If you can take the pain and you can take the suffering of climbing, it doesn't matter how fast or slow you'll be. You'll never be the guy that stops on a climb. All right. The other way that you can work on that mental toughness is doing consistent anaerobic endurance intervals. Those zone 5 repeats are a great way to work on your anaerobic endurance and your mental capacity to perform those anaerobic endurance intervals. All right, again, we get down to the mental aspect and the psychological aspect of things. And finally, breathing is a very specific very specific aspect of your ability to suffer. I'm not going to go over breathing here. I covered it in, I believe it was a two-part blog post on my site on tailwind-coaching.com or The Daily Grind. I covered that on there probably back in the spring, if I remember correctly. But I will include I'll include a link to those posts in my blog post that contains this podcast, so you can take a look at breathing. Nonetheless, breathing is extremely important. The ability to not overrun your body's capacity to get oxygen in, to and the importance of using your breathing as a mental and physiological control for the amount of stress you are under. All right. So those are very quickly the ability to suffer and part of the mental and physiological aspects of suffering. So that was a tough podcast, and I realize I'm running a little bit long. Next time in part two of the climbing podcast, I'm going to go over some information and some specific workouts. Okay, those of you who are listening to the to part two are going to get a nice treat. You're going to get some specific workouts for various types of climbs that we as cyclists and myself as a coach deal with training my athletes and training myself to tackle. All right. So until next time, folks, I hope this information has been of value to you. I hope you found it useful. If you like what you hear, again, please head over to iTunes and rate this podcast favorably. I'd like to reach more and more people if I can with it. Okay. If you're on Stitcher, Blueberry, Podbean, or whatever, please head on over to iTunes and do that. If you're looking to get a hold of me for consults or for emails or anything else, be aware it takes me a couple days to get back to you, but I do return everybody's email that I receive. CoachRobDC@gmail.com. You can find me on Facebook at the Tailwind Coaching Facebook page, or you can find me on the website at tailwind-coaching.com. And there's a number of ways to contact me on the website as well. All right. So again, I will include links to a lot of the stuff I've talked about here in this podcast on my website. I will also be looking to put up a coupon for my training systems very soon. And again, I only have one spot available for personal one-on-one coaching in the next couple months. All right. I'm looking forward to getting into cyclocross with you guys. And after the climbing, next climbing podcast, that's probably where we'll be headed. But until then, I want to thank you all for listening. I want you to ride safe. I want you to ride happy. Get strong, be well, and kick ass on those climbs. Keep the rubbered side down, and I will talk to you real soon in the Climbing Podcast, Part 2.